Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again with another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, we'll start this podcast by wishing everybody a Happy New Year. This will be the first episode of the Nolcast for the 2018 calendar year. 2017 was a fantastic year for us. Very much appreciate everything that we were able to experience together and all the feedback and support that we received from our listener base. So just want to begin the podcast by thanking you guys. It's been a fantastic year. We've got a lot of really excited things that we're working on and going to be able to continue to bring you quality content in maybe an even more frequent manner in a couple of different methods. So exciting what's on the horizon, and just want to thank everybody for what they've made possible in 2017 and, well, hell, really all the way back to 2010 or 29 whenever we started doing this podcast. So very much appreciated the listener base, and also Louisiana hot sauce, simple product, fantastic end result, three ingredients, and as consistent as an item as I've encountered. And they're a great partner to work with, and they happen to have a great product that both you and I love, and we couldn't be more fortunate to have the relationship with them that we do.
Absolutely, man. Happy New Year to you, and Happy New Year to Louisiana hot sauce. We got a lot of fan questions today, which is awesome, and appreciate the listeners. And we did pass 1,500 five-star reviews on iTunes sometime recently, so that's pretty awesome. Three categories today. We have coaching, football, and recruiting, just like Louisiana Hot Sauce has three simple ingredients. And so we have three simple categories. So we're going to go through all those. You want to just start at the top?
Yeah, let's just jump into coaching. I know a lot of people are, you know, it's topic du jour. Some in the fan base are on the edge of a building about to jump off because we haven't named a defense coordinator quite yet. So why don't we just begin the discussion with what is a reasonable timeline and what people should expect from this process and kind of how it plays itself out.
Well, I think some people are wondering if Willie Taggart's even going to have a defensive coordinator.
Yep.
I mean, clearly it's time to flip out. All right. I say that with sarcasm, but I realize that, look, I work in the industry, so I kind of understand the timeline, and other people don't. So that's why they rely on us. So I'm not trying to belittle folks. What is a reasonable timeline for getting most of the coaching hires done? Well, the dead period ends on January 11th. Dead period is the time in which you cannot actually contact recruits. That's not in person, not calling them, not texting them, that type of stuff. You're just not supposed to have any contact with them. Unlike the quiet period where you can still do, you know, non-face-to-face contact. Right now, you know what most coaches are doing?
I do. And the whole calendar was tipped on end because of the early signing period. It's a whole different process. And most coaches are actually trying to get reacquainted with their family and taking a second away from the office right now.
Exactly. They're enjoying some family time. They're seeing some friends. They're trying to remember what their kids' names are. Nothing's really going on right now. I mean, maybe they're spending a couple hours looking at some film of potential recruits, but for the most part, they understand who they want to offer. And look, if when a new coach gets hired, he's going to get handed a sheet. Hey, this is who we're on. This is who we feel like we have a decent shot to get. These are kids we still need to call just in case, that type of stuff. So January 11th, and I know people are like, I know today's the 3rd, right? That's 8 days away. Mm-hmm. People are going to lose their minds, but that's okay. Because, you know, Willie Taggart's not operating on a fan's timeline or a comment section timeline or a message board timeline. It's just not. He's trying to get the best guy and the best fit that he can get. So for defensive coordinator, whether that's Jim Leonard or, you know, whether that's maybe a guy on the Georgia staff or maybe a guy on LSU staff or Alabama staff, who knows? I think those are all very possible things. By the way,
I don't know that that was just a random hypothetical.
Yeah. So I think that that's something to pay attention to. Now, Georgia and Bama are still in the playoff, so they probably won't have firm decisions made until after that. When's that playoff game?
Next Monday.
The 8th?
The 8th.
Is that the 8th or the 9th?
Yeah, it's the evening of the 8th, I believe.
So that gives you 3 days after that to have your hire made by the end of the dead period. And I think most of the hires will be made by January 11th. Maybe there's one or two that scrambles. Recall as well, look, we're going to have a lot of coach movement, not just at Florida State, but all across the industry, because what day does the new coaching hire rule go into effect? And the new coaching hire rule that I'm referring to, if people don't know, the size of assistant staffs approved by the NCAA is changing from 9 to 10. This is the new 10th coaching rule. We've talked about this a lot on the show, but if you're a new listener, I understand. We're going to have a lot of movement across the industry. So expect news kind of in that week. That sort of midweek next week is when you're going to see a lot of stuff happen. Now, I'm not saying stuff can't happen before. I think some stuff probably will happen before. Something that may happen by the time this podcast is out, we'll have to see, is the Greg Fry news. Greg Fry, offensive line coach, and I think he coaches tight ends as well for Michigan right now. Florida State grad from Clearwater, was on the 93 title team. Really kind of a mega recruit back in the day. I was 8 years old, so I don't really remember this, but looking back, he was kind of on those super prep lists and all those old 900 numbers you could call. Pretty cool stuff.
I used to call those things. I did. Yeah, I got into recruiting at a bizarrely young age, but that was a wild time. Wild time. You get little paper monthlies or weeklies sent to you depending upon the time of the year, and you'd call in and listen to somebody charge you, $4.75 to give you a 30-second update on a kid. So, yeah, not all that different than it is now.
I mean, okay, so back in the day, was that the best 900 number you could call? I mean, like because it's on your parents. It's on your parents' bill, right? So if they find you with a 900 number.
Yeah. Growing up as a product of a single mother, I think if I had to explain to her as to what 900 number I was calling, the mom, I just gave Jamie Newberg $3.50. That would be the best thing that I could have a possible explanation for.
I mean, that's pretty solid. So we reported, Tomahawk Nation first to report, other sites confirmed our report, that Greg Fry was on campus yesterday. So that's probably a good sign. Michigan lost their bowl game to South Carolina, and Greg Fry made the trip up. I think Greg Fry will be the offensive line coach for Willie Taggart. I'm pretty confident in that. I'm just not sure exactly what day that's going to happen. That's some good news there, I think. And I'd be pretty surprised if he's not. If he's not, and again, I don't have any reason to think he won't be. We previously mentioned Danny Hope as a guy, so that's maybe the backup plan there. But I don't think they're going to need a backup plan here.
No, I fully expect Fry to be the guy. That's a really nice hire, and just a really nice mesh of things, of a talented candidate, a guy from the state, a guy who happened to play for your first national championship team. I think a lot of reasons people can be excited about that hire when it actually becomes official.
Oh, some other thing. Dave Kelly. Dave Kelly has joined the staff at Florida State. We'll see what his title will be. I don't expect it to be a coaching title. I think he's going to be a front office type guy. He was previously at UCF. Also, for a while, was a high school coach in Georgia.
He was, yeah. This is funny. Now, he was actually the guy that was at Oregon that we realized at like 2:20 in the morning his follow list. Wasn't that David Kelly?
One of those guys, I believe.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm almost positive it was him. That was one of those bizarre, 2 a.m. podcasts that we put out for a while there. But anyway, yeah, Kelly was a coach at Dunwoody High here in Metro Atlanta for a while. Coached some really exceptional teams that were ridiculously loaded with talent. By the way, I mean, there was a joke around Metro Atlanta at the time that Dunwoody High might have had a higher recruiting budget than Georgia Southern did in the early 90s. They were
a joke.
They had a
huh?
kid named Travis Stroud, who was one of the top defensive tackles in the country. I mean, they were getting kids from wherever they needed to go get them. I'll put it that way. Yeah.
Hey, man, you need recruiters.
It sounds like a good director of football operations.
Yeah, exactly. I feel kind of weird about this because we were getting some criticism online for not reporting more stuff. And to be honest, I didn't think people would really care about a front office hire. But asked around, and despite the fact that we don't have any sources anymore, here's three more names for y'all. Trey Hackett, Sherrod Everett, Julie Reed are three other people I expect to follow Willie Taggart from Oregon. All will be working in the front office.
Y'all front office, yeah, okay.
Yep. Interesting. So no sources, Noelcast here.
Dropping
three more names for
I'm
you.
I'm not even going to concern myself with that talk. Ridiculous.
I don't know. I felt bad. I was like, really? People care about? Yeah. Oh, okay.
Here's front office hired. Yeah.
New janitor as well.
I can understand. I think people are just so eager for any kind of news.
I think that's probably it. I'm not trying to be salty.
All right. So we'll move to the football section of this podcast here. We've had a couple people reach out to us and ask, in our opinion, were the playoff results positive for Florida State? I mean, I'll let you give your opinion. I really don't think the Clemson-Alabama game, it's good for Clemson to not continue to be this mega giant, but they're still one of the premier programs in the country. I don't know that there's a ton that would have come out of that. I will say that it would have been nice if Oklahoma could actually beaten Georgia. Georgia, we've talked about it, and this is not something we just started talking about either. We've talked about this for a good period of time. Georgia ain't playing around, and Georgia's going to be a thorn in the side for a lot of people in this part of the country.
I totally agree with that. Now, the one thing is that Florida State does not play Georgia on an annual basis, but Florida does. Now, they both recruit against them, but Florida actually has to play against Georgia and face those kids that they're going to lose the recruiting battles to. Georgia's, we've already talked about this. I think Georgia's going to be the new Alabama.
That will be really interesting, Bud, though. I don't mean to interrupt you, but in that the dynamic of the Georgia-Florida rivalry, Florida people do not expect to lose that game. I mean, you know, they've been spoiled over the past 20
yeah,
years.
About that.
That's going to be a serious – they're going to have to really come to terms with that they don't just have a birthright to kick Georgia's teeth in every year.
Yeah, that's accurate. Over the last 3 years, so these are Kirby Smart's classes so far, Ingram, 74% blue chips.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not normal. Mm-hmm. That's not a thing that normally happens. That's pretty ridiculous. Florida, 44%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Florida State, 67%. Now, that's still pretty damn good. It's better than Florida for sure. Georgia is just, they're on a different level right now. We'll see how long that can last. I think they have some staying power, certainly with the quarterbacks they're signing. But yeah, look, the playoff result in terms of who won the games, probably good for FSU. Now, I agree, Oklahoma beating Georgia would have been better. But look, Clemson getting to the title game again would not have been good. So Alabama did FSU a solid there. I also kind of think Bama winning it over Georgia would also help a little bit.
It would.
You know, because
a complete agreement.
Really good tweet by one of our colleagues here at SB Nation, Ian Boyd, and he said, you know, Alabama winning just seems so normal in a year without a truly transcendent team. Like, they're basically the default. And that's pretty much true. You know, you look at the quarterbacks in this playoff, Mayfield, but Oklahoma didn't have, you know, the same amount of talent elsewhere on the field that these other teams did. And the other teams don't have special quarterbacks. You know, Jalen Hurts, how many balls did he throw downfield? Five?
I mean, this is the same story with that guy for a while. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, but like, did you watch the coaches' show breakdown, by the way? Like the national championship or the playoff, that they have all these different views. They have regular ESPN, and then they have like the all 22 view, and then they have the view with the coaches sitting in there. And it was Gary Patterson, Larry Fedora, Holgorsen, exactly. By the way, absolutely hilarious moment there. I don't know if people caught this. When Gary Patterson is discussing a play, and I think subconsciously he's doing the hand signals that Holgorsen actually uses, and Holgorsen calls and he's like, wait, what? Like, Gary. And it's because Gary's really known for picking signals. And Gary's like, I don't know what signal they use for this. He's like literally doing the signal that the air raid teams use to call the play in, which is pretty awesome. But there was a stark difference, I think, between their analysis for Georgia, Oklahoma to Clemson, Alabama. And Alabama, like with Georgia, Oklahoma, it was awesome. They were really all into the scheme and stuff. Clemson, Alabama, they had nothing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically the same thing for like an hour. And then Gary Patterson took like a half an hour bathroom break. It was basically, well, Alabama can play two deep shell and still stop the run, even against a running quarterback. This is pretty amazing because every single one of their defensive linemen is apparently fully healed and just in their, you know, their final form.
Mm-hmm.
And like they're all winning their one-on-one battles routinely. This is incredible. And so for Alabama, they just didn't take any risks. Like, hey, let's throw a screen. And then the coaches in the coaches room are like, oh, how big is that guy? Like 6'8", 300 at running back? They're just all making fun of just how big the Bama guys are. And it is true. They are a different looking team than everybody else, even than Georgia at this point, I think. But they just didn't take any risk. And the coaches were agreeing with it. Like, hey, well, you know what? There's the only way you're going to lose this game is if you turn the ball over a bunch somehow. So you just keep throwing little screens behind in the backfield and having Hurts scramble. And that in college football, if you're that talented, that can work. So I do think the playoff result was good. Clemson making the playoff probably doesn't help Florida State. Georgia making the title game doesn't help them. But overall, there were certainly worse possible results from the playoff.
Agree with that. Bud, we had a question about the comparison of the composition of the staff from Florida State to Florida. Just give us your quick thoughts there. I feel like this is something we might have touched on in a past podcast, but wanted to make sure we acknowledged Eli's question and just give a general review and contrast of the two staffs.
Yeah, I got to figure out who's actually on Florida staff real quick. I know they have Billy Gonzalez and John Hevesy, right, who are from Mississippi State, and they also have Todd Grantham. I don't think Todd Grantham's a bad hire. I know some people do, but I think he's had pretty good results. He just happens to have, you know, sometimes he has some meltdowns and gets sort of like anger blitzy, if you will. Doesn't always handle the up-tempo spread stuff real well. I know that that Houston team really gave them fits with how they adjusted to some of that stuff. I do wonder if Grantham being with Mullen, you know, a guy who does do some tempo spread stuff, maybe will help him adjust to that. But I think that's a fine hire. We heard Sal Sinceri's name mentioned as a potential hire on defense. That's an older staff. I'm just thinking about this. How old is John Hevesy? He's not super young.
No.
Billy Gonzalez is like 40, I'd say mid-40s, probably 46. Grantham's got to be in his 50s, right? Yeah, John Hevesy's got to be in his late 50s. He was born 19... Wow, really? This guy looks much older than this. Born 1971, so that makes him 47?
Yeah.
Yeah, 46, 47. Okay, so that's kind of a medium older staff. I wonder how much Sal Sinceri has left in the tank as far as recruiting goes. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why he wanted to go back to the NFL. I don't think he's going to keep many guys from the staff. Maybe keep Juwan Sider. I think I probably would as a recruiter, but I just don't know if we can answer this question fully until we see the staffs, you know, filled out. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like, because they're only about half full right now.
So, Bud, we started the podcast by acknowledging that it was 2018 and wishing everybody a happy new year. But I want to revert to a conversation that we had at the beginning of 2017. And it was a talk about the defensive tackle class that Florida State was able to put together. And I think the point that we made and you made in particular is as true now and in fact, probably even more truth surrounding it. And that was that Florida State was really fortunate to get the defensive tackle class that they were able to secure the two in-state kids, Parks and Durden, and how big of a deal that was just because of what the future defensive tackle class looked like.
Oh, it was so huge. And people, I don't know, other fan bases would tell me, oh, that's not true, and there's always talent. Edgar, I'll pull up Miami's. You pull up Florida's. Pull up their current recruiting class right now, if you would. Yeah. Scroll down with me. You see any elite defensive linemen in their classes? Miami's got one.
Elite. I don't see any elite defensive lineman here. I've got a three-star defensive tackle. Nope, I don't even have
for that. Florida?
No,
oh, no. Okay.
No.
Huh.
Yeah, no. The kid's more of an offensive tackle.
Miami's got a four-star commitment I actually like a lot, Nesta Silvera, but only one of them. And they have a defensive end in Greg Rousseau, and they have Patrick Joyner. But those guys are in. They're not tackles. They really only have one guy who's, you know, large-sized on the defensive line. And that's because it's not a good year in the state. And it's something we saw coming over a year ago, and so we hounded on it. You know, that's interesting, man. We'll see how they can do next year. But certainly their depth is going to take a hit. Because in 2017, go to 2017, if you would. See who they signed that year. John Ford, who I don't think Florida State necessarily would have taken in their class, but you know, looks like a pretty good signing for Miami, actually. And nobody else.
Yeah.
Anything else on the Florida side there? I know they got the kid at American Heritage last year, who I actually liked a lot, but not a lot of depth, man.
They're looks like a got a kid out of Hampton, Virginia, the Elijah Conleaf, if I'm mispronouncing that.
Yeah.
And Kyrie Campbell, who comes from a school called the Wyoming Seminary Prep, which is frequently synonymous with getting quality defensive tackles.
It is. That is so, a defensive tackle factor.
Yeah, you go and get your seminary kids and you turn them right into difference makers on the line of scrimmage. That's a tried and true formula for the last 60 or 70 years in college football.
Now, here's the real scary thing. If you're a Florida fan, you may want to shut this off because this is going to be kind of depressing. And I swear this is not the Georgia cast. Jamari Sailor, five-star offensive guard. Kay Mates, five-star offensive tackle. Trey Hill, four-star offensive guard, who I think probably should be a five-star.
One of the best interior linemen that I've seen over the past 3 years. Really good player.
Warren Erickson, number five center in the nation, four-star offensive lineman. Oh, that was just this year for Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Going to 2017, Isaiah Wilson, number one offensive tackle in the prep ranks. Andrew Thomas, who I think was awesome, you know, number nine offensive tackle. Natori Johnson, number six guard. DeMarcus Hayes, JUCO tackle that they signed last year. Justin Schaefer, three-star guard, you know, not too bad. If you're Florida, you're about to get blocked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a real good point. State of Georgia has produced a lot of talent along the line of scrimmage over the past 3 or 4 years. More, you know, Georgia, I'm always bragging about how many kids come out of the state and that it's a great talent source, but they've really put out some freaks along the line of scrimmage, and the University of Georgia has been the large beneficiary of that, as you would expect them to be. But yeah, that's a great point as far as the line of scrimmage and what Florida State was able to secure last year and leading up to a pretty disappointing class for defensive tackles.
Yeah, it's just not a good, like, I don't think there's a five-star D tackle this year nationally. I've seen, I think, all these kids at this point, and like Teron Vincent's a good player. He's not like a Lawrence type kid or Marvin Wilson. He's just not.
Mm-hmm.
He's not that good. I think he's the top rated D tackle this year, or at least in the composite. And none of these kids are that level of player, in my opinion. So it is a down year for the position, certainly.
All right, bud. Good places, any to remind our friends as to the fortunate partnership that we have with the For the Table Restaurant Group. And I something that we've talked about a couple of pods here. Starting on January 8th, you can have food and booze delivered to your doorstep if you're in the Tallahassee area. That's going to be through their mobile app. Again, we'll continue to talk to you about that, but that is For the Table app, ForTheTableApp.com. Just encourage people to add that to their phones or their iPads and take a look at what's possible. I cannot even begin to verbalize how much I would have abused the hell out of this thing had it been in play 15 years ago or so. But anyway, Madison Social and ForTheTableApp.com. And man, the idea that you can bring the quality of food, and this is one of the reasons that we love Matzo. It's not just because they get the fan base. It's not so just because they're, you know, plugged in with what's going on and some of the own pieces of content they produce as far as merchandise and stuff like that goes. But just the base level of food that they serve is fantastic. And the idea that you can bring Township, Centrale, Matzo to your doorstep, That is unbelievable. It really is. And to encourage people to take a look at that and use it as much as they feel comfortable doing so.
Absolutely, man. And you know what? If I'm in Tallahassee right now, something I'm not doing, going outside, because it is snowing. And I know this because
my entire timeline is
on Twitter. Exactly. It's snowing. Oh, my God. So Madso already delivers right now using Penny Delivers, and you can use that for all their off stuff. I might go get a pizza from Centrale. That'd be awesome, but I can have it delivered to my door. Probably not going to leave my house. Take a little snow day, but if I did want to venture out, you know, get inside, get some of that awesome, you know, one of those awesome burgers, that BLT dip, and have yourself a good time there at Madso Centrale Township, or maybe some donuts from Sodo. So thanks for Madso for being on for another year, let's get back into it.
Bud, David asks a question here. How much did the unrest in the program behind the scenes, due to culture issues or problems with Jimbo directly, or not really knowing if his head or heart was truly with Florida State, attribute to the lack of on-field performance? This question particularly towards so much fire, Kelly Trickett type of sentiment. Are these assistants really as bad as the on-the-field product shows, or more a product of general unrest and animosity within the program?
You know, I think it's really hard to separate that. But it couldn't have been a good place to work for the last year under Jimbo. We know it wasn't. Should those guys have been retained? Was it like, did they get an unfair rep? I think perhaps unfair, but not necessarily totally inaccurate, if that makes sense. Like, did the culture impact Charles Kelly's ability to coach defensive backs? Maybe somewhat, but they still didn't have very good technique. And the offensive line didn't play together as a unit, you know, very, very well. They made a lot of mental errors. That's a really good question. I'll be interested to see how Charles Kelly does at Tennessee because Jeremy Pruitt hired him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where Rich Trickle will land. I guess we'll have to check that.
I don't know that we can answer. I mean, I don't mean to echo what you said, but I don't know that you can really parse exactly what that was. There were some cultural issues in this program even before I think your head coach decided to leave. I mean, we've talked a lot about about a lack of real buy-in over the summer. I mean, they're just things that you can see that this wasn't headed in the right direction. And, you know, once the head coach and staff kind of stopped having recruiting meetings or stopped contacting some of the better players in the country, I think that probably, you know, stuff, an attitude like that begins to permeate itself throughout the program. I don't know exactly when that took place. I don't know when it had an effect on this individual or if it impacted this unit of play. There's just too much ambiguity in this situation for us to be able to give a real hard, you know, pinpoint answer to what caused this or how this certain scenario impacted a particular segment's level of play. But it's a very interesting question and a legitimate one, in my opinion.
Tyler asks, how excited are you about the running backs next year?
Exceptionally. I mean, I think between – look, if we were running Power I, I'd be real excited about our running backs just because we've got – Florida State has a stable of exceptionally talented people, and one in particular that, as he gets more familiar with the running back position, has potential to be as good as he wants to be. So I think that so many kids on this roster – I think Zakondre White has real potential to make a solid contribution. You just got a absolute ton of talent stockpiled at that particular position.
Laybourne, by the way, tweeted like that he was excited about next year. Mm-hmm. So looks like we can probably put those rumors about him leaving to rest. That'd be good. It's time now for some recruiting talk, man. This has kind of dominated my world recently.
Let's get into the crew talk here. So the first question we received, or how are and these are all Florida State commitments and fact signees. Did Litton end up sending us LOI?
He did. Okay, he did.
Good.
Yeah.
So all these kids are signed. Just wanted to make sure about that. How are Robert Cooper, AJ Litton, Sante Samuel Jr., and Christian Meadows doing at the Under Armour competition this week?
They're all doing pretty well, and they're all basically what I expected them to be. Meadows, to me, has been a little bit, like, not super flashy, but again, I don't like evaluating these kids on all-star practices for a couple reasons. Number one, everybody treats all-star practices differently, right? Like, some are really hyped up to be there, and some look at the trip to Orlando as a vacation, as they should. Mm-hmm. They're done with their careers. They've already signed, you know, with the exception of Meadows, who's just committed and he's going to take some visits. You know, their motivations are all different. And some of these practices aren't even pads. They're not getting that many reps because there's over 100 kids out there, and you're looking at three-hour practices from 10 to 1. The first 10, 20 minutes are basically like, you know, how you feel? Fired up. That type of stuff where the Under Armour guy comes out there and indoctrinates them into the brand. And that's not an Under Armour thing, by the way. Adidas does the same thing at the Army Bowl and at the opening. You know, everybody's like, how much do you love Nike? Mm-hmm. All that kind of stuff. I don't even go to the first 10 to 15 minutes of these things anymore. Like they start at 10. I stay up in Winter Springs at the in-laws when I'm up here. And I leave at about 9:30 so I can get to Disney at 10:15 just so I don't have to, you know, sit out there and see the kids stretch and do the clapping and all that stuff. Then they do like install, which you're not getting a whole lot out of an install. And they also practice special teams, which I could probably do like a 30-minute rant on why we don't need special teams in all-star games, but I'll give you like a 2-minute version here. It's dumb. Nobody comes to see kickers or punters at an all-star game. And the product on TV on these games is bad. It's not a good product to watch. If I did not work in this industry, there is no way in hell I would watch any of these all-star games. And I know the Army game is an NBC property, and you know, SB Nation is obviously affiliated with NBC. The reason why they're not a good thing to watch is chemistry. These kids are only together for 3 practices. Today's is actually canceled, and they're going to walk through inside the Orlando World Center Marriott because we have freezing rain here right now in Orlando. Additionally, they spend about 30 minutes of their 3 hours, so about a sixth, on special teams, which is silliness. We don't need to do that. If I was running these all-star games, extra points, they're automatic if you want. Okay, cool. You got 7. If you get inside the 20, you can take 3 points if you want on fourth down. That's cool. Punting, all right, you get 40, 45 yards, whatever, or if it would go into the end zone, a touchback. Just automatic. That's just where the ball is going to be. Now, This would make the game more exciting because the special teams are not live anyways. You can't block the punts right. and the field goals.
I was going to say, you've already modified the game here.
Right.
Exactly. You can't block. You can't try to block a field goal, et cetera. Yeah.
Unless you're Damar Dorsey back in the day. But that's that true. was a very special kid.
That's the best performance ever turned in an all-star game in general. So,
yes.
Both level of play on the field and lack of concern for any type of guidelines, whether they be rules or anything else. So,
if Damar Dorsey had put the same amount of energy yes. into being like a quality human being, then he would have probably been in the NFL.
Yeah.
So just do that. And then check this out. Do you think, Ingram, if I gave you an hour and a half more time over three practices as an offensive lineman or four practices, that you could actually have better chemistry with your other offensive linemen and maybe the quarterbacks and receivers could be more on the same page and thus the product on television would be better to watch? Because I do.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, when you look at the percentage of time used, it's hard not to think that you wouldn't see an uptick in the level of play.
Like right. when they go to special teams, I walk to the other field if I can, or I go hit a bathroom break or pop some tweets off or something. But there's no point in it. I would eliminate the special teams from this. Also, every year we get the rosters, and I'm like, who the heck are these two kids? And they're inevitably long snappers. Mm. And I always freak myself out. I'm like, wait, there's two Under Armour All-America level kids that I don't know. I've never even heard their names, right? And I'm Googling, and I find nothing because long snappers aren't even listed on the internet. That's just my little two-minute rant on special teams and all-star games. We don't need it. Cooper has looked good with his power. He's not going to be a great pass rusher. Don't expect him to be. AJ Lighton has been Velcro all week. Asante Samuel Jr., from what I've seen of him, he really sees the game at a good level. And you say, hey, that's the kid of an NFL guy. Yeah, and he definitely he's been well coached, man. Aquinas does a good job with their kids. He's not a physical freak, but he does seem to break on the ball really early and sees stuff developing and. In zone coverage, he comes off his guy and picks balls off, and that's been cool to see. Christian Meadows, obviously, is coming off a foot injury. He's had some good reps. He's had some reps that were kind of so-so. I like that kid's attitude and his physicality when he's healthy, and I'm not worried about him. So that's how they're doing it Under Armour All-America Week. We'll see how they play in the game. I don't know if I'm going to watch the game. I will probably just DVR it, but that's kind of my take so far on the UA game.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know your answer just based off your last response there, so we won't spend a whole lot of time on this. But in your opinion, any Florida State recruit have the potential to receive a star bump in particular, that fifth and final star?
I would say to a five-star, no. I think that Cooper is accurately ranked as a four-star. To me, five-star D tackles need to be able to make – an impact in the pass rush game as well, and I'm not sure that he really necessarily will make a big time impact in the pass game. FSU already has a five star commit in Jaden Woodbay, obviously. Lighton and Samuel Jr. are undersized corners. Now they're good, but to me, I'm not really into ranking guys who are 5'9", 5'10" as five star corners because of the length and the physicality thing. That a bigger guy, a 6'2", like Pat Surtain Jr. freak type dude could do. So that to me would be a no. And then obviously Christian Meadows, I think, is probably appropriately ranked as a four star. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say this. Amari Gaynor should be a four star. That's silliness. For him to be the second lowest rated kid in their class just in front of Chaz Neal, that's foolishness. I mean, I don't think there are 18 better or 20 better outside linebackers than him in the nation. But that's a bump from 3 to 4, not 4 to 5. So I guess that's not really what the question was asking.
Okay. A question here before we get into the question I'm really excited about. But somebody asked, and I've heard this a decent amount from some in the fan base, how will UCF's success, if it impacts Florida State at all, what level might it display itself?
I would say zero impact.
Yeah,
it is not. It's going to impact other guys or other programs. It might impact like mid-level Big Ten programs. Mm-hmm. But Florida State does not lose kids to UCF. You could put Nick Saban at UCF, and Florida State still would not lose kids to UCF. It doesn't happen. It won't happen. It's just a different level, right? Florida State Stadium is twice as big. They have actual tradition and all this other stuff. It's just not happening. I know that, like, if you don't cover recruiting, then, like, as a sports writer, there's about a 2-week period of the year where you wade into the recruiting thing and start to give your opinions on them, and they're usually hilariously wrong. And if I had time, I would do – you remember the blog Fire Joe Morgan?
Yes, I do.
Okay. If I had time, I would actually probably do some Fire Joe Morgan stuff. Maybe we'll do a segment on that on my Aspiration Recruiting podcast at some point. But, no, UCF and USF and those type of schools are not taking kids from Florida State, ever. Not kids that FSU actually wants. Not kids that FSU can actually get into school. Dave asks, we get a lot of Daves today. I'm apparently not as smart as some of your listeners, and I'm probably somewhat naive. But I have, Dave, I'm sure you're probably pretty smart if you picked up on this. But I have some general questions about the whole recruiting process. You have recently commented about some programs that are, quote, fully committed to recruiting in a tone that says, quote, wink, wink. You have mentioned the use of, quote, presidents, including Benjamin Harrison. Come on, guys. Yeah. Did I say Benjamin Harrison? If so, I apologize for that. The implication seems to be that for a school to bring in a really outstanding recruiting class, they must be cheating. I thought the NCAA had strict rules prohibiting payments and limiting favors to recruits. I understood that some programs, such as Ole Miss, have recently been in big trouble because of, among other things, recruiting violations. So can you help me understand what is permitted and what is not? How prevalent is blatant flouting of the rules among major college football programs? Do schools get away with it because they just do a really good job of covering up their cheating? Yes, yes, yes. Very prevalent. If you're a high school coach and you have good players, you should be able to get paid to bring your kids up to a school.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, I think that you should be able to get paid above the table to bring your kids up to the school, because high school coaches don't make any money in this state, and that's a shame. But I do think that if you have really good players, you will probably get a couple $100 handshakes, and that's to every major program out there, every one. Now, the issue is that when the money gets so big, how do you clean it, right? And we're kind of talking about money laundering here in a way. But so if I was a parent of a recruit, you know what I would probably do? I would either put my house up for sale.
Yes, I was going to say I'd either start a small business.
Start a small business. Or yes, exactly.
Have a interest in selling my house. Maybe a car dealing business, a car detailing, something
possibly, yeah.
Low level of investment needed. But you could potentially show some real growth potential.
Yeah, because I want to show that my books are really – a cash business would be really good. Mm-hmm. But if I have ever a five-star son, Ingram, or you do, we're selling an old cast, man. We're the first $5 million podcast sale ever.
Yeah. Must have had a quarterback. Well, I guess at that point in time, who knows what inflation will be. But, yeah.
Okay, so the common stuff, right? You know, just paying a kid. The cars thing teams don't like to do because cars are basically like an invitation to get pulled over in a car, depending on who it's registered to. So you got to figure out the registration, all that kind of stuff. Jobs for parents, helping parents find apartments or homes if they want to move closer to the school, which, you know, happens a lot. Obviously, buying the parent's small business or buying the parent's house at way over market value.
Worth pointing out that, the school is not doing that. You know, this is an LLC wrapped in an LLC owned by somebody else. I mean, there's a lot of layers in kind of getting to what his final series of questions are. The schools that are able to recruit at a high level that do so consistently have such an institutional level of doing this that they're not just running around throwing, $10,000 cash at a kid on his unofficial visit or something like that. Let me give you an analogy for when it comes to cheating on the recruiting trail. You don't want to be like the flashy surface at the top of the river. You want to be way below with just some smooth institutional help, whether that be buying real estate assets or anything else below the river where maybe it's not quite as easy to see.
Exactly. Here's the thing for you. If, hypothetically, let's say 10 years ago, the number one junior college quarterback turned down a bid of $180,000 for potentially a larger sum. Think about this real quick. That was a decade ago. So we've seen insane inflation in college football since then, as far as, you know, salaries and the money. That's a junior college kid.
Yeah, it was about to, exactly. JUCO kid.
So you're only getting if he's good, you're only getting him for 1 year. What does an elite high school kid get at the quarterback position? Like a truly five-star
Yeah, well, that's the reference I just made when you said we sell the Nolcast for $5 million.
Mm-hmm. I think they're probably getting $1 million.
I think we are approaching a period of time where $1 million in assets change hands. I'm not saying somebody gets $1 million cash, but potentially $1 million in assets are tied to, you know, maybe. And hey, look, if you're a kid and, you know, say you can get 3 or 4 programs that are desperate for you and think that you're going to be their guy, and you can, you know, you can pin a Florida State off of Georgia, off of Auburn, off of LSU or something like that, then yeah, you can get into the bonus round pretty quickly.
Couple things here. Are all kids getting paid? No. Are we going to talk about specific evidence kids getting paid? No, because I'm not into that. And I don't think that's, A, if you're doing it right, people are not going to know about it. B, I think these kids should get paid anyway. You know, if they played another sport, they would get paid right out of high school. Instead, they got to play the most dangerous sport, mm-hmm. and pray that they stay healthy for 3 years before they can get a chance to have the shortest career of all the professional sports.
I would love to see some of this stuff brought above board. I'd love to see a kid with an annuity, basically, and have the ability to maybe, you know, look, if you want to continue the sham that is this idea of amateur athletics and that they're not getting paid at the time, fine. You know, put $200,000 in a pool that they can draw upon in 5 years or something like that. There's things that can be done, and I would, particularly for what you just talked about, the amount of money that these kids make at school and the amount of just ridiculous one-sided risk, physical risk, that these kids take, we would be well served to address this and have a real mature conversation and maybe bring some of this stuff above board.
Let me ask you a question here, hypothetically. Hypothetically, of course. If you could go back in time in your Jimbo, how much would you have paid Jameis to make sure you got him?
$2.5 million.
Like if Alabama says, I think I'd probably go to $5 million, you know, to win a national title, to break the SEC streak, to do that at the time.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe I was undervaluing it. $2.5 to $3 million would be where I'd land.
I mean, absolutely. And that'd probably be a steal when you look at the returns FSU got on that.
Oh, it would. Yeah, it'd be a bargain. It would. That's what I'm saying. You know, everybody shudders when you talk about creating money for these kids. Well, it's there. It's absolutely there. There should be a better way to have this play out. That's all I'll say. And I'm all for these kids getting as much money as they can. I'm all for these kids' moms getting jobs, maybe even no-show jobs. That'd be great, too. I'm just, you know, there's an awful lot of value that these kids bring to these institutions and not necessarily represented in the scholarship that they receive.
Last thing here, some 2020 offers are going out. There's a kid, Ingerman, we like to play this game called Where in Georgia Is That? Because there's about 1 billion counties in Georgia. Do you know where Nashville, Georgia is? Not Nashville, Tennessee, but Nashville, Georgia.
Yeah, I have a general idea. I do not know exactly where it is. I believe it's, you know, somewhere between Macon and the Florida border, but I'm not sure exactly.
There's a kid for Berrien High School in Nashville, Georgia, and it is in Berrien County. His name is Jamarcus Johnson, Jamarquis with an apostrophe between the A and the M.
Okay.
Johnson. And he looks great, man, and no offers yet. His coach DM'd me and said, hey, you know, can you get this kid's name out? And usually when coaches do that, you know, a lot of times the kid is not all that good. But Johnson looks really good, man. He's running around out there. He looks, I'm not saying necessarily talent-wise at this time, but very talented kid. On offense, he kind of runs like Vince Young did. And on defense, he reminds me a lot of who was the kid with the hyphenated name who went to Louisville out of South Georgia, the safety. Remember his grandpa wanted him to go to FSU?
Harvey Clemens.
Josh Harvey Clemens. He looks like that on defense. So definitely a kid that I think should be on Recruit Nick's radar. And if you listened all the way to the end of this show, that's probably somebody to take a look at. Surprise me if he starts to get some good offers.
Okay, so Nashville is in kind of this – I don't know what to term this part of Georgia, actually, but it's an area. It's just a swath that you can go. Now, 2020 kid, somebody will find this kid, but you can go unnoticed. It is just southwest of Tifton. It's right off. It's not right off of 75, but it's within probably 20 minutes of east of 75 between Tifton and Valdosta. And really, from everything from that point west, basically until you hit the state line of Alabama, it's just, man, you can go unknown in there. It's just so, Georgia geographically is so large, and there's so much, I don't know how to explain, not necessarily the highest quality of schools, and it's just a rural, remote area. So interesting, and I'm not knocking Berrien County School. I don't know anything about it. I'm just saying that there's situations where you can find kids last minute in this parts of the state, this part of the country, because of certain larger factors. But a name to keep an eye on, and something we'll certainly watch and see how it develops.
If you're on 75, if you get off at the Adel exit, mm-hmm. it's about 25 minutes east of that.
Yeah.
So it's not like something. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of cities in Georgia, by the way, that are kind of like, they're not the biggest city of that name in the United States. There's a Lakeland, Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
There's a just literally on the map right now, I've got a Albany, Georgia, which obviously I think people know about. Nashville, Georgia, Lakeland, Georgia, like Jacksonville, Georgia. Man, Georgia's just straight up stealing names of other bigger cities, man. This is, you know, Arlington, Georgia.
Okay. Damn.
Wow. Yeah. I don't know. I like to play this game because Ingram used to work in state government, and so he knows a lot of these places, and yet, like, we still snub him sometimes, so that's always good. And Columbus, Georgia as well, which is not that tiny. All right. You got anything else this week?
No, man. I think that was good. Happy to be able to put one of these together. Good to kick off 2018 with a pod, and excited to, you know, we got a little bit of recruiting left, obviously, but just a final note. I really wouldn't worry about this coaching staff. I think you'll have some pretty significant coaching news. I think people will start to see pieces of the staff come together, and ultimately, it's going to be a really competent staff that can recruit at an exceptionally high level, and have every reason for optimism that we did 2 weeks ago or so when we first started talking about what this staff might look like.
On a general scheduling note, tomorrow is the Inter-Army All-American game. However, I'm actually leaving before that. I'm going to San Antonio for the Army game tonight on the 3rd, and then I will be in San Antonio through the 6th, and then on Sunday I'm driving over to Dallas for one of the big 7-on-7 tournaments of the season. And then, so we will probably podcast, I think Monday the 8th will be a good target for that. Most likely, because I'll have seen the kids in San Antonio, and that will be a new, fresh topic to have. If they hire a defensive coordinator before then, maybe we'll jump on and do like an emergency defensive coordinator podcast. But I think that makes a lot of sense to do it on Monday.
Fantastic. Again, thank everybody for everything that you did to make 2017 the year that we had. Just incredible feedback. Thank you again to our sponsors. And always feel fortunate to be able to do this, and look forward to continuing to bring in you guys content throughout 2018.
Yeah, man, 50% growth despite me, you know, missing 2 weeks due to Hurricane Irma. That was pretty solid. That was a great year from y'all, and we appreciate all the great support. And look, we don't advertise, so it's basically just word of mouth. And that's credit to y'all, so very much appreciated. Thank you.